This is The Think Tank, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. With Dr. Mike O'Neill and hosted by Mike Russell. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
This is September, and this is our kickoff show. Arizona History, Four Perspectives in the Month of September. Our kickoff guest for this sequence is Marshall Trimble, Arizona State historian. Welcome.
Nice to be here, Mike.
Just to put it in perspective, next week we will be talking to the man I describe as the most important Arizonan that you may never have heard of, Dick Mallory. The week following, Governor Fife Symington, who I guarantee you will provide a lot of history and at least one blockbuster statement. And cleanup batting will be Jack August, historian, I think an old friend of yours.
Yep.
This week, we're going to talk about Arizona from, your mandate is from creation till about World War II, where we pick it up with Dick
okay.
Mallory. You are the state historian. How did that happen?
It happened under Fife Symington's term, and I was guest lecturing for a teacher's professional growth program sometime around mid-1990s, I guess, and I was teaching fourth-grade teachers. They teach Arizona history, so I was there for – it was a professional growth thing, and afterwards they asked the instructor – Dr. Buescher, they said, does Arizona have a state historian? And he said, no. And they said, you think Marshall would let us make him state historian? And he said, well, why don't you ask him? So they asked me. These were persistent teachers too. I said, a lot of luck with that. You know, politicians usually only call me when they want a favor, and if I want something, I'm on hold for months at a time. So. I said, good luck with it. And it took a couple of years, I guess. And I got a call from the governor's office one day saying, we're naming you state historian. Would you come down to a ceremony at the Capitol? So I did. And the rest is history.
So,
that was 1997.
No unlimited term of office, too, from what I understand. This just goes on and on.
Well, it doesn't pay, so that's why I'm still there.
Well, then they can double your salary.
Yeah. I ask for a raise every once in a while. They offer to pay me what I'm worth, and I say I don't work that cheap. But, no, I have to be appointed by each new governor.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, so, and I have all of them, and I'm still waiting for Governor Ducey to call, but I know he's been busy.
Well, I guess you stay on until he figures out otherwise.
Until they bring in a rookie or a younger person, I guess. I'll just keep on. You know, when I was appointed, the reporters asked me then, said, what are you going to do now that you're state historian? And I said, the same thing I've been doing for 30 years. And so it's the same thing.
What does the state historian do? I mean, we're talking about being appointed and what do you do?
Well, I go around. I never know what the day's going to bring.
Okay.
I answer questions. I lecture, I guess lecture. I've taught Arizona history, and I've published more than 20 books. And I just was a resource for everybody, reporters from outside the state and inside, and politicians and that kind of thing. And I think it's pretty much ceremonial. You know, I show up at these things as state historian. And the first time it was offered to me, it was offered by the legislature back in around 1990. And I turned it down because I thought it might be political. And my wife said, Marshall, you made a mistake. You shouldn't have turned it down. People are always asking me, she said, well, what does he do? He's a writer. He's a teacher. He's a performer. She said, you got nothing to really hang your hat on. And if they call you state historian, you got something to hang your hat on. And when people introduce you, they don't have to do all this other stuff. They just say, ladies and gentlemen, this is our state historian. And I grab the microphone and run.
Nice.
I want to find you. I looked up, you grew up in Ash Fork. Now, I got to tell you, I had to go to Wikipedia to figure out what Ash Fork was. What kind of town was that?
Well, when I lived there, it was in the late 1940s and up to the mid-50s, and it was the heyday of Route 66. It was just after World War II, and a lot of traffic. Passenger trains coming through all day long. It was busy. and the town was hopping to mostly bars and restaurants and motels, but it was a great place to be a kid. And the high school, my high school only had about 30 students, and so we always say our driver's education class and our sex education class were both taught in the same car.
Now, Mike probably doesn't, too young to remember this, but I remember the old days. You get your kicks on Route 66.
That's right, yeah, and it was. I learned to drive on Route 66. It was just a little narrow, winding mountain road. We climbed up the hill to Williams for a change of scenery. That was our big event. Cruise Main Street and Ash Fork for a while, and then go cruise Main Street. It was something like right out of Larry McMurtry's The Last Picture Show.
66, absolutely. This was the route before they built the interstates, where if you were going cross country, it was Route 66.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've seen they have taken pieces of asphalt and mounted it on plaques, mm-hmm. and people buy them.
Oh, yeah. It wasn't such a big deal then. I mean, I remember when I was playing high school basketball, they asked me what jersey I wanted, and I said 66. I want 66. So I wore number 66.
I'm surprised you didn't have to fight for
so
that.
So I must have had a little bit of a historical conscience then, but I didn't. But, you know, those were the only outsiders we ever saw in town, were the people passing through, and they were just blowing through real fast, stopped the gas, and my mother was a waitress in a roadhouse cafe there, and my dad was working on the railroad. So
this is iconic.
I should write a book about that sometime. It's a little too close to home, I guess.
Now, I want to bring out the dirty laundry, because I understand there is a rumor floating around here that you actually, in your teaching career, taught John Talton. Is that true?
Yes, John.
We quote here
I
all
never
the
time. Knew he was going to become famous, but Coronado High School, I was really blessed to be at a school like that when I first started teaching. And it was just a good, mostly middle class, but great students. I'm still in touch. I left there 40 years ago, and I still, thanks to Facebook, things like that, I hear from John. And
now,
there are a lot of
others. What was he like as a student?
You know, I can't remember. It was 40 some years. It was maybe 50 years ago.
I get people that all the time from my teaching. You got to remember, there's one of you, there's a whole lot of them, and it's asymmetric.
Well, you remember some of them, and they'll come up to you at places, and they'll say, "Do you remember me? I was in your class." And they'll say, you probably don't.
Yeah.
Well, I say that. Yeah, I do. And then, but some of them, I'll say, well, of course I remember you. I just, a young lady, well, she's not young anymore, I guess, she came. And I said, well, of course I remember you. And I remember your two brothers, both of your brothers I had in class, too. And she was really floored. But sometimes they just, for some reason, you don't know why, but usually you remember.
We are beginning our four-week series, A History of the State of Arizona. We're starting it off in style with our state historian, Marshall Trimble. More next.
Come back. We'll talk about how he kills Santa Claus.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are back with historian and storyteller, Marshall Trimble. And I don't know if the T's made the cut or not, but you once killed Santa Claus, or so I'm told.
Well, no, I told the story. I wrote the story about it. It was Christmas, 1932 or 3. The Mesa was in a depressed. I was born in Mesa, and Mesa was in a depressed situation there. And
that was probably country back then.
It really was. Yeah, you knew when you're leaving Tempe and driving for a while and around. Through
and
fields.
Same thing from Phoenix to Tempe. There was a void in between.
Yeah, I was born in that area. Actually, we lived in Kyrene, and then later we lived in Lehigh. Mm-hmm. And then later I taught school in Mesa, so I had a lot of ties to Mesa. But they wanted to do something to promote business, and it's my favorite. I tell it at Christmas whenever I'm doing a show at Christmas time. It's one of the staples. And he came up with this bright idea to lure because the Depression had really put a dent in people's pocketbooks. And the merchants in Mesa were all worried about, well, what are we going to do? What are we going to do to get our stores, get the cash registers jingling? And so he came up with this brilliant idea, have Santa Claus parachute out of an airplane, and then he would land and then lead the Christmas parade through town. And they thought, well, that's a brilliant idea because Lindbergh had just flown the Atlantic just about 5 years before, and parachuting was really something new and daring and risky and all that. And they, so the whole everybody was built, all this anticipation built, and they hired a stuntman to dress in a Santa suit and then parachute out of this airplane as it flew over right around Alma School Road, where Alma School and Apache Boulevard are. There was a field there. It was University of Arizona Experimental Farm later. And he, well, on the day of the event of the Christmas parade, they found him downtown in a bar. He was so stiff, he was just frozen to the bar stool, and so they had to get a replacement real quick. So McVeigh says, "Here's what we do: we put a dummy in the airplane and a Santa suit. The pilot pushes him out. He parachutes down. I'll be in another Santa suit on the ground. I'll jump out of the bushes, and I'll jump on the wagon, and we'll lead the parade through town."
Do you know who stole that idea? I just remember. I saw this on television. The old TV show, radio show, WKRP in Cincinnati, about the radio station.
I remember that.
Yeah. Do you remember the skit? Yeah.
No, I didn't remember the skit.
Here was the skit. Basically, they got this idea for promotion, and they said, we're going to get a helicopter, a plane, and we're going to drop turkeys from the air. They're birds, and they'll fly down, and they drop them down. And, of course, they realize turkeys don't fly.
Yeah, they glide,
and
yeah.
And you hear the, of course, it's radio. You're hearing, you're not seeing it, but you're hearing the thing about that. Oh, my God, it's carnage. The turkeys are flying, are hitting everybody. They stole your idea.
Yeah, well, what happened is it didn't open. The chute didn't open. It just went thump, and it just plopped on the ground. And all these little children, you know, children are more sophisticated today, probably, thanks to the media. But these kids really were believing, and they were crying. And
Lord.
He jumps up. He's unabashed by this. It doesn't bother him. He jumps out of the bushes as if it was the resurrection of Santa Claus. And he gets on, and he leads the parade. By this time, all the farmers and all the Mesa people have taken their kids home, and he thought it's time to take a vacation because the merchants were ready to hang him. And he took a vacation and came back in a couple of weeks thinking they'd forget. But he died in 1968, and the front page of the Mesa Tribune that day said, "A man who killed Santa Claus died today." And they never forgave him or forgot that he was,
he did for his entire career in his life, he's now the guy that killed Santa Claus.
You know, that's all the important things he did in life as a newspaper editor. But, you know, you mentioned the turkeys a while ago. That reminded me of the great rancher Henry Clay Hooker, who came into has a Sierra Bonita ranch, which still exists in Cochise County today. And he made his money during the gold rush and the silver boom in Nevada. He went up to San Francisco, and he bought a whole herd of, I guess you call them a herd of turkeys, to bring them over to sell in Virginia City. And as he brought them over the Sierra Nevada, they got to this edge of the cliff, and the turkeys jumped off. And like they committed suicide. They knew what their fate was, so they committed suicide, these turkeys. He's all depressed because he had invested in this, his whole fortune in this in this herd of turkeys. And they rode down to the bottom to see what was left of them, and the turkeys had glided down to the bottom of the cliff, and they were all waiting for the cowboys or turkey boys, I guess, when they got down. And he took them over to Virginia City and sold them for $10 a piece in a mining town, and with that money he came down and bought a big ranch in Arizona.
You know, there's something about turkey that I think makes it's just inherently funny.
They are funny
animals.
Yeah. And Ben Franklin wanted to be the national.
Wanted to be the national bird, and somebody complained they were too stupid. I think
that would have been really fodder for other countries today if our national emblem was
the
turkey.
Now, that would hardly instill fear in the hearts of your
enemies. No, it doesn't.
Yeah, don't tread on me with a picture of a turkey.
Turkey.
Okay, cowboys and Indians. I got a serious question for you. Do we still have a residue of cowboy culture that impacts our thinking of who we are here?
Yes, we do. It's very the cowboy culture will probably never die as long as people are eating beef. There are ranches. I attend cowboy poet gatherings from time to time and cowboy reunions and places like that. You know, up in northern Arizona, the Babbitt Ranch still going strong up there.
I mean, at a kind of a psychological level. A cowboy is this guy who sees himself as independent, don't mess with me, kind of. You know, like Mike here.
It is. It is, and whenever somebody says American, we can take on anybody. They say, "Oh, that politician is a cowboy."
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, that's the that was one of the hits on George W. Bush. He's a cowboy,
right?
And that's what they meant.
Yeah,
it was a metaphor.
They said the same thing about Reagan. Yeah. He's a cowboy.
Yeah, it was a metaphor for a kind of a swashbuckling kind of.
Yeah, and
character.
I'm surprised they haven't said it about Trump. They probably will sooner or later.
Well, I don't know. He's got a little too much New York to be a cowboy. They make that. What was that commercial about the chili? You know, where's this? This comes from New York City.
Yeah.
This
New York City.
This can't be the real stuff.
No, the image of the cowboy is really self-reliance. Your word is reliable. A handshake. You don't need a contract. It's that whether it was true or not, and it was basically true. I've known people who it used to be that way down here in the legislature when you had a lot of cattlemen representing them in the legislature. Don't have them anymore.
You know, there's a difference in that regard. I read from around the turn of the century, and I mean the 19th or like 1900s, there were all the business books were all about character.
Yeah.
And now they're more about how to, you know,
raise money.
Finagle and screw and whatever.
Well, self-reliance, independence, and that is really the cowboy spirit.
All right, more with state historian Marshall Trimble. And I'll tell you this, through this whole show, I've got one question for him. One question only. We'll get to that next.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
I have family from all over the country. They're spread out everywhere. And we have Marshall Trimble, state historian here. If I had my family come in, I invited you over for Thanksgiving. They all looked at you. They're not from the state of Arizona. They don't live in the state of Arizona. They're going to ask you to tell them one story. One story that always pops in your head when somebody says, "Tell us about Arizona." What's that one story?
I get a lot of those, and I've got so many favorites. But one of my favorites was a woman named Josephine Williams, who graduated from nursing school. She was from the Sand Hills in Nebraska. She went to Chicago and graduated from nursing school and was immediately diagnosed with tuberculosis. This was around 1900. And that was a death sentence, really, in those days. And she said, "Have I got any chance of anything?" And the doctor said, "Have you ever heard of Arizona?" And she said, "Well, I've heard of it. Where is it?" And he said, "Here's a map." And she took all the money she had, and she bought a train ticket. She passed her folks in Nebraska, and she told them she was escorting a tuberculosis patient to Arizona. It was herself, but she didn't want her family to be worried. And she got on the train, and her ticket ran out at Ash Fork, Arizona. And she said, "I'm supposed to go to Phoenix. I need to get to Phoenix." And he said, "Well, it's 196 miles by rail to Phoenix." And she had no money, so said, "Well, it's a long walk." And she said, "Well, I'll do it." And she walked. She started walking down the railroad tracks, and a train pulled up beside her. And they stopped with a caboose, and the brakeman stepped out, and he said, "Lady, where are you going?" She said, "I'm going to Phoenix." And he said, "Well, it's 190-some miles to Phoenix from here. How are you going to do that?" She says, "I've got to get to Phoenix." And so he said, "Well, how would you like to ride in the caboose?" And she said, "Sure." So she hopped on the caboose and rode into Phoenix. And she got a job working as a nurse. She was the first trained nurse in Phoenix. And in fact, that was what she was referred to as, that trained nurse. And she was shopping one day at a local mercantile store and department store, and she caught the eye of the owner, and it was love at first sight. They married, and a year later, they gave birth. In January of 1909, they gave birth to their son, and they named him Barry. It was Barry Goldwater.
Good
and,
night.
And by the way, she had an just this all this great interest in Arizona. She took those three kids, Bob and Carolyn and Barry, loaded them up in a touring car, and drove them all over Arizona from Monument Valley all the way to Douglas, the Mexican border. And she camped. They camped every night, and they sat around the fire, and she lectured. They fixed their dinner and cleaned the. Boys gather the firewood and everything. They did. As soon as the camp was the dinner was done, they sat around the campfire and she lectured to them on culture, on history, on the Native Americans, on the geology, everything. She was a walking encyclopedia on Arizona, and to his dying day, Barry remembered those lectures with his mother around the campfire. And by the way, she did not die for many, many years. She lived a long life after coming here to die of tuberculosis.
Wow.
But Barry, I've always thought that Barry Goldwater's passion for Arizona came from those campfire talks. And a lot of times, probably the kids thought at that time, "Oh my God, another lecture around the campfire at night with Maul," you know. But it really had an effect on him, and I think that really had a lot to do with what he did with his life, you know, outside of politics.
You know,
photography. He traveled all over, just an adventurer.
Fife Symington told the story about the first time he met Goldwater. He's like about 10 years old, and he's in this mansion and where he's growing up outside of Baltimore. And Barry Goldwater, then a senator, pulls up in his Corvette and his cowboy boots, and Fife thought he was just the coolest man on earth.
There's that cowboy image again.
Yeah.
Cowboy in a Corvette.
Powerful metaphor, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't see the cowboy in a Corvette, though, but yeah, we'll run with that one.
You know, I talk to fourth graders a lot during the year because they study Arizona history, and I go in there, and I'm wearing boots, and I'm wearing jeans and a Western shirt, and I got a hat on, but I got a guitar strapped on. And those little kids, they just light up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not me. It's that outfit.
The whole deal. It's the whole package. Want to ask you, Lost Dutchman Mine, one of the great mysteries of Arizona. We had an attorney general who used to go out there all the time.
Bob Corbin,
for,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
What's the story on that? Is there gold back in there somewhere?
No. You know, it's a great story, though, and I love lost mines because they don't cost the taxpayers a penny. You don't have to build a restrooms. You don't have to build a visitor center or anything because it's out there. You don't know where it is. And I've dealt with a lot of lost mine stories, but the Dutchman is my favorite because it's close. And another anomaly about Arizona, the Dutchman wasn't a Dutchman. He was a German.
We couldn't tell the difference. Was that the story?
It started out as Deutschmann, I think, but Deutschmann doesn't work very
funny.
Well. So remember, they called the Deutsch, the Dutch.
There was gold, and for example, California Gold Rush turned Levi Strauss into a billion-dollar corporation.
Yeah.
There was money to be made, not in gold.
Yeah, those are great stories. Yeah. The ones who really got rich were the ones who
selling stuff to the miners.
Yeah, there was a guy named John Allen who came into Tucson in the 1850s. And it came out, you know, he probably going to be a miner like everybody else came in. But he found out that soldiers and all the prospectors and miners and things liked pies. So he started making pies and he sold them for $1 apiece. And next thing you know, he's not John Allen anymore. He's Pie Allen. And he becomes famous as Pie Allen. And when the boom came to Tombstone, he went to Tombstone and they named a street after him, and the most notorious street probably in Western America is Allen Street in Tombstone, Arizona. It's where all the raucous behavior took place during Tombstone's boom years, and it's Allen Street, named for not for a gunfighter or a famous marshal, but for a guy who made pies.
I visited there. I love the one Tombstone. Les Moore,
shot
to death with a .44,
yeah,
no less.
No more. Oh, it's a colorful day. I spend a lot of time down there. In fact, I'm going down in October to give a talk on the social life in Tombstone. everything but the gunfighting. I'm going to talk about what they did because it was a very rich town. They had you could get oyster under glass. You could get all kinds of varieties of wine. You could go to a French restaurant, an Italian restaurant, a Chinese restaurant.
Wow.
They had all of these amenities, and people think, well, I was standing on a corner down there one day about 5 years ago, and a man comes up with his family, and he says, say, the next gunfight is not for 45 minutes. What can my family and I do while we're waiting for the next gunfight? And I said, there's a great underground mine tour, a good lecture, a lot of important information about Tombstone and the mines. And he says, they had mining here? No, they just had a gunfight every 45 minutes.
Right.
Wasn't it in a lot of these towns, didn't you, when you got into town, didn't you have to check your gun at the door?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, Tombstone had a gun ordinance there. You had to check your guns. That was what started the whole thing with the O.K. Corral fight, the O.K. Corral fight, I should say, is these guys were wearing guns and... You were supposed to check them coming into
when
town.
When you went into town, mm-hmm. And pick them up on your way out.
Yeah, there were a lot of you just checked them at the marshal's office. You could leave them at the livery stable. You could even leave them with a saloon keeper. But that was to curtail the violence, but it didn't always work because they did have the fighting. I mean, you did have Curly Bill and people like that in town.
I guess if you're going to fight, you're going to fight.
Yeah, and about the only real recreation was booze, and you get a little booze and a guy strap, and that's why it was really good thinking that they thought these guys are going to be drinking. They're wild.
What could go wrong, right?
Yeah. And they're packing guns. And if they're not packing guns, it may lessen the chance of them shooting each other. Maybe they'll just duke it out.
Guns and booze. Don't threaten me with a good time. I was born in the wrong era. I'm telling you that. Good night of living. Marshall Trimble, thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Mike.
We love having you here. Please come back and share these stories with us. And is there any place that we can find your books? Anything that you have going on your website?
Well, they're Park and Swap and Freddy's Texaco and Ash Fork. No, you can get them at any bookstore. You can get them at Amazon. And I have a new book out called Arizona's Outlaws and Lawmen, which is doing real well, I understand. And that's my latest. It just came out in April or May. And so, it's they're still in the stores. And
all right,
kind of book once you put down, you just can't pick up again.
Well, wonderful. Thanks so much for being with us. Doc and I are going to gunfight it out next.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Well, way to go, Doc, as you do a lot of the bookings here for the show, that you're going to start our history month with
If we're going to talk Arizona, let's start out talking cowboys and Indians.
Man, how cool is that? I just love that. Yeah. It's way cool. And the stories, especially about Barry Goldwater, you know, it speaks a lot to it because we have the Goldwater Institute and all of that. And Barry Goldwater's an Arizona icon.
And got to remember, Barry was here when Arizona was the backwater. It was the place where you get to find Arizona by going to California, turn around, and come back.
Exactly. You hit a river,
I mean, we are now. If you rank order the states by size, we're dead in the middle, but we were 48.
Sure, exactly. We were, yeah.
And kind of a dust bowl without much there and a whole lot of color.
Yes.
A whole lot of color, a whole lot of stories, but not a whole lot of people for a long time.
He's going to help me in my bid for state mine inspector. You watch. He is going to be an asset to me in my bid for state mine inspector. I'm going to be the state mine inspector. The Lost Dutchman was a German. That's absolutely hilarious. I just think that's one of the funniest things that man said. So I'm going to put you a little bit on the hot seat here.
All right.
You are a bit of an Arizona historian. You know more about Arizona than most people I have ever spoken with. And it may be politically, I think, is really
not,
where
not
your
the
real
early
horse
stuff.
Is.
I mean,
we're not talking about Barry Goldwater and the campfires,
I mean, next week we start talking to Dick Mallory, mm-hmm. post World War II. That's where I kind of that's what I call recent Arizona history, where basically World War II, it's a corrupt government, a bunch of businessmen get together and decide they're going to clean it up, and sort of sow the seeds of their own destruction in that. They clean it up, they get rid of the corruption, and then over a period of decades, there's a building resentment to hey, we're a democratic country, and these guys, big guys, are just controlling everything.
Right.
And so that sets up the next great drama.
And I understand that, but I think there was a brief period in there where the corruption was cleaned up. I think I think the corruption returned just in different forms. I don't think I get a lot of argument from anybody on that.
Yeah, money and politics are whole. I mean, our corruption now is a completely legal one. You want to run for president, you start out, you find your own personal billionaire.
Sure.
And anybody who's in the race at this point who's making serious inroads has their own personal billionaire, and you can't get them out of the race. Used to be when you're in single digits in the poll, you drop out because your money drops
up.
Out.
Yeah.
Right now, if you got your own personal billionaire willing to keep writing checks, you're in until they get tired of you.
And this has nothing to do with the D or the R, but I remember when we knew Hillary was going to run, was when Bill secured her private jet. Because, and that was, once again, not a D or an R, but it's just the way of things now. It's just you have your bankroll, and that's the way it goes. So the corruption just changed, really, but it became legal. Yes.
It became legal.
Right.
First of all, it was legal in the beginning. You could fund anything, and then we had campaign reform, and it said you can't have big money in politics. And then with Citizens United, now we have a back door, and you got unlimited spending, and now we just don't get to see where it's going and who's paying.
Well, I mean, Citizens United, we're talking that's recent history. In the grand scheme of Arizona, that's basically yesterday is what that is. But I want you to dig back a little bit, if you could, because this has been a good storytelling episode of the Think Tank. Reach back into what is it, as far as you want to go back in your time here in Arizona. What stands out to you?
Wow. Well, I came here in 79, and I've been
okay, Doc, come on, man. I was four. Come on.
So growth was one. And the interesting thing, and we're going to talk, next week to Dick Mallory, I came here and there's this sort of remnant of the Phoenix 40 seems to be running everything. And there's this young upstart kid who decides that the Phoenix City Council is basically appointed by the Phoenix 40 because everybody's costs too much to run. Everybody's elected at large.
And the Phoenix 40 is just everybody's
Phoenix
on the same
40
page.
Was the leaders of the captains of industry, the newspaper, the banks, the major institutions of town, the big boys, who would sit down and decide who was going to be on the city council. And there was this kid who passed petitions to say, let's break that up. Let's do it at a district level, because at the district level, you can run on shoe leather. You can knock on doors and you can do it. That guy's named Terry Goddard, and that's sort of the beginning of the modern era of Phoenix politics. And he successfully passes this petition, and you have probably the most interesting election ever, because all of the office, there's no incumbent. The big problem we have, or one of them with politics, is the power of incumbency is so immense that nobody, look, we just reelected a Phoenix mayor. We always reelect our Phoenix mayors. When Mayor Stanton retires, then we'll have an actual competitive election again. Somebody will get in and they'll get reelected forever.
Okay,
that's been our history.
I honestly think people are almost crashing their cars wait a second, we had an election? What happened? That snuck up on us, came out of darn near nowhere.
Ho-hum. And by the way, he's not the only one. Terry Goddard is reelected. All of our mayors typically the pattern has been you have a really contentious election, competitive, somebody gets elected, and then they're in as long as they want.
Okay. So, but that's basically the way it is.
It's the power
everywhere.
Of incumbency.
It's not Arizona. That's not Arizona.
Oh, it's not even only about mayors.
But
it's conspicuous. Once somebody's been in, they've never had a serious challenge again, ever.
Yeah, why not? You just sit there.
As far back as I can remember. That's a lot about it. So that, to me, was the beginning of the modern. It was modern to me because I was here to watch it.
Sure.
I remember, for example, one of the things that he did symbolically, the city hall doors were chained shut.
Huh?
Okay, you had to go in through a side door. It was a security thing. And Terry got in there, and he takes the chains off the door, and they throw the doors open, and we're...
For the people!
We're bringing in open government.
Here we go.
It was a wonderful symbolic opportunity. And, that was after, first, with one session, he put in district elections. He wasn't elected to anything. And then subsequent to that, he ran for mayor against the Phoenix 40 candidate, Margaret Hance, and beat her. And that was sort of the beginning of the sort of demise of Phoenix 40 as sort of the dominant power in town. There now you have Greater Phoenix Leadership. You've heard arguments. Mm-hmm. We'll hear them next week about how influential they are. To me, real power is exercised when stuff doesn't see the light of day. We will talk, for example, about the issue about the discrimination ordinance.
Sure.
When you have real power being exercised, that never happens in the first place. They beat it down after it caused a furor and looked like it was going to cost us a fortune. But those were outsiders trying to influence things after the fact. That isn't power the way it was exercised in the 40s and 50s and 60s, because then there were private decisions made about the way things were going to be, and the stuff never made it into the paper in the first place.
You know, I'll say this, and I'll probably have the opportunity, I hope I will, to challenge Dick Mallory about this. I think that the new power is, well, not the new power. I think the power still is money. I think it's the golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules, and that's how we're dealing, because we're dealing with electoral politics, which means you get your next campaign win, and that has to do with
money.
But
what's changed is that money used to be from Arizona institutions, major ones, the banks, the newspaper, all those kinds of folks. And now it tends to be outside and anonymous piles of money that are coming in from we don't quite know where.
Right.
And so there has been a sea change in that regard. But absolutely, does money drive up? Show me somebody's funding and I'll show you who's in the game.
Exactly. And and you look at that, and that's your wheelhouse, by the way, with the polling. But you look at Sheriff Joe's a perfect example of this. The majority of his stockpile has come from outside of our borders.
$6-8 million. Tough haul. Even though his popularity has been dwindling, anybody going to take him on is looking at $6 or $8 million and counting that they're going to have to face and realize will be directed at them. That's a very, very tough one.
We mentioned cowboy with Marshall Trimble.
He's a real
cowboy as they could possibly
well,
be.
Well, he fits that mold, doesn't
he? Does.
Yeah, swashbuckling. Yeah. You know, it's like
you hear the whistling in the background.
Donald Trump would be a cowboy, except he's too New York.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
I fear no man, Marlboro man. I speak my mind.
And he's
doesn't
the
matter
sheriff.
If what you speak is nonsense. If you speak it and you people feel like it's what you really feel, they love it.
Right, and he's the sheriff.
Yeah, sheriff.
I'm the sheriff right
here. Sheriffs and justices, the peace.
Yeah.
We got the legacy of all those things that are, you know, that are absolute legacy of that history.
And it's shining in Arizona. It is. And when you said when you were talking to Marshall, I think you said the residue still of the cowboy culture here. Yeah. I think it's alive and well. I don't think it's residue. I think it's a good slice of our pie.
It's part of our ethos and who we think we are, and it still plays.
And I like it, and I think it helps us survive. I think it helps us survive as a state. He talks about if you eat beef, you're darn right. You go out to my side of town and the west side of town, you'll see some cowboys out there, and those cowboys are just doing good.
A whole lot more people that think they're cowboys than really are, though.
Well, that's true.
Sheriff Joe.
Anyway, and we shouldn't have said that. That was probably me. And he's the sheriff. All right.
Tune in next week, second piece, Arizona History with Dick Mallory.
All right. This is the Think Tank, KTR News.